So hello, everyone. My name is Larissa Grolemond. I'm Associate Curator of Manuscripts at the J. Paul Getty Museum in Los Angeles, and I am here with Kellen.
I'm Kellen Michael, and I was formerly an intern in the Manuscripts Department, a graduate intern from 2021 to 2022, and now I'm working at the Hammer Museum, and I was the co-curator of this exhibition.
Today, we're going to be talking about the dual institutional project between the Getty Museum and the Morgan Library in New York about the Book of the Marvels of the World. And this was a project that was conceived in 2022 after the acquisition of a manuscript at the Getty, whose sister copy lives in New York at the Morgan. So we're going to talk a little bit about the project overall, the publication project, as well as the process of exhibition planning, both exhibitions in Los Angeles and in New York, concentrating on the one in the Getty. And we'll talk a little bit about the manuscript as well and what the Marvels is. So hopefully we'll touch on a few aspects of what it means to bring medieval art to the public and what does that mean in 2024, the year of our Lord 2025 now. And what kinds of things do we think about when we translate this material for publication, but then also what does it mean to show this material in the gallery? We'll just get started, I think, by talking a little bit about the manuscript that this is all based on. Both the book and the exhibition were created in response to the acquisition of this manuscript, the Book of the Marvels of the World, or in French, the Libre des Merveilles du Monde. But we use its name in translation in all the material for accessibility reasons. This manuscript was acquired by the Getty in 2022, and it is essentially a mid-15th century French manuscript. It was illuminated around 1460 in Angers, and it is basically an encyclopedia of different places of the world. And what's so special about this manuscript is that each of its 56 chapters are illustrated. And they have this kind of amazing, fresh, dynamic visual quality to them. And Kellen, I'll let you talk a little bit about what the contents of these images are.
The Getty acquired this in 2022, but it was a long process of acquisition up to that point. And so when I started in September of 2021, one of my first goals was to come up with ideas for an exhibition that myself and Beth Morrison, senior curator of manuscripts at the Getty, we could co-curate together. Halfway through that brainstorming process, Beth came to me with the Marvels, and just immediately what struck me was the impressiveness of the illustrations. Each illustration, which matches up with an entry of a location or a region, has these little vignettes, and each vignette correlates to a portion of the text that corresponds to that region. It serves as both an illustration of the text, but also it compiles a lot of vignettes from the text all in one place, so you get a visual overload. And that was something that was really intriguing to me. As someone that studies text and image relationships, I was really interested in how the image could serve a function that the text might not be able to. And yeah, just the illustrations are gorgeous. If you have had a chance to look at them, you know what I'm talking about. And if you haven't, I encourage you to go and take a look.
The Marvels as a manuscript is really an interesting object, and it is an interesting object because it does really place equal weight on text and image and the relationship between those two, as Kellen said. So we know that the text of the Marvels was originally drawn from a larger Latin work, and it was translated by a French monastic scholar named Pierre Bersuire, who basically excerpted this aspect of a much larger text. And each of the entries, which is on a different global locale, so everything from really near locations to the center of France. So there are places like Provence and Italy, but there are also much further flung places like Sri Lanka, India, and China, places that medieval Europeans would not have known by direct encounter with them. So the text really presents a huge variety of different kinds of knowledge, from mythology and hearsay about these places to aspects of the cultures and even resources, natural resources that were much more intimately known. And so you really get this large variety of knowledge all collected together. And it's almost like a stream of consciousness text. And it's as if the images translate that stream of consciousness into visuality. So the artist is making sense of the text in some ways. And you get this very creative approach to visualizing a text, which I think gives us a little bit of a peek into the way that the medieval European mind is working and the way that it is translating these really far-flung places and maybe exotic places for a particular kind of audience, an armchair traveler audience, as we describe it in the book. So why was it important to present the manuscript in this way, and in this way meaning for the general public? Why was it important for us to think about the way that this might be relevant to the public today?
I think that when Beth and I were talking about the exhibition, and then also when we were talking about translating the exhibition into a book and what a book could give beyond the exhibition, we were really interested in making not only medieval art approachable to a more general audience, but also to allow the content of the Marvels to illustrate how a lot of ideas about places near and far have started in historical time periods that people in the present day don't necessarily always connect to our current worldviews. And because, first of all, the Marvels is not the origin point of a lot of the ideas that are presented within it. A lot of the text itself is being taken from ancient Roman writings, ancient Greek writings. So ideas about what constitutes us and them have been around since people have been around. And the Marvels solidifies that in both text and image, which was something that was really special, not only having the text, but having the image as well, and being able to share that in an informative way with a modern audience and be able to explain how these conceptions of near and far began to a certain extent, but also changed over the trajectory of time and how they still stay with us today and how we see prejudices that come up today that are rooted in these older ideas.
So a way of making sense of not only the world in which they live, but also the world outside of them and that basic conception of us and them, which feels like, in a way, so human and so natural.
Exactly. I think today we think of ourselves as a much more global society because we're instantly connected with things like the internet to people in faraway places from our own. But taking a step back and showing that, we all still have these prejudices, having these instant connections doesn't just automatically override all of those prejudices that have been building up for centuries, and showing some of the origin points or the midway points of those preconceived notions, I think, is really interesting to bring to a more general audience.
I think what is so fascinating about manuscripts like this is they feel at once really historically removed. We're talking about something that was made in 1460s France, which I think feels extremely far away, very foreign to a lot of people today. When they see it, they think, this is beautiful, but it doesn't mean anything to me. Then you start to dig into it and you start to look at these images, which are the technique is really, it's cool because they take up a big portion of the page. Each image is big and colorful and super detailed. And you start to really look at the vignettes and the narrative aspects of all of the images and start to see these really fun narrative details, but then also these pernicious stereotypical details that relate to racial identity or ethnic identity. And the things that are built into that form this foundation of visual knowledge, which would have been legible to a medieval audience. And you start to think, we do this. We have these stereotypes and we present people of different racial backgrounds in these particular ways, or we understand images to mean certain things in certain contexts. I think there's an interesting way that presenting medieval art as fundamentally relevant to a modern audience starts to get at the way that visual knowledge works on a more macro level too. Yeah. And being able to parse those images in a medieval context is the same way that we parse images today.
We look for these cues that mean something to us in whatever context we're currently living and working within. And I think that what's really interesting about the Marvels is that even though not everything in the images reads for a modern audience, there's still plenty of things that we can pick up with our own modern worldviews where we're like, that's weird. And that's exactly what the Marvels illuminator and authors were getting at as well. They wanted whoever was considering the manuscript to also have that type of reaction. And something else that was super intriguing to me about the manuscript in general is I don't think I had ever come across something where this is where the title of the exhibition came from, Wonder and Fear in the Middle Ages, where something beautiful and strange and also incredibly prejudiced could all exist on one plane and exist simultaneously. In the text and the images, you're getting these things that are both really offensive. You are getting compliments of people from faraway lands, and you're getting everything in between that. And that to me was super interesting. All of this exists on a spectrum. And yeah, that's how we still work today. That was just so cool to me.
The Marvels came out of a private collection to the Getty's collection, but it has, of course, a much longer and more varied manuscript tradition. The Marvels is relatively unique in that we know of several surviving copies that are all quite similar. One of those copies, essentially the sister copy, is held by the Morgan Library, as I said. There is one earlier copy from around 1425, 1428, a fragmentary copy in the Municipal Library of Angers, which is only two illuminations. The Getty's copy is not complete. The Morgan's is. So we do have a sense of what might be missing from the Getty copy by looking at the Morgan's. And then there's actually a later version, 1480 or so, by Robin A. Testard, which is essentially unrelated to the first group of four. The manuscript tradition also provided this really fascinating body of knowledge because we can see the negotiation of these places and the way that they're visualized changing from the 1420s all the way through the 1460s and 70s with the later copies. And it also gave us an opportunity to collaborate with the Morgan and with Josh O'Driscoll, the associate curator of manuscripts there, on the publication and then a sister exhibition as well. First, Team Marvels worked on the publication. So I thought we would just maybe introduce the publication a little bit and the goals that we had trying to translate this material for both a scholarly public in some ways and also a more general public. The book is really the first publication of this particular copy of the Marvels. So it was important to have a really complete accounting of all the images and exactly what was going on in them. So we have this great, I think, great plate section.
We might be a little biased, but
yes. We also wanted to make it as accessible to a general public as possible. So we have a series of essays, an introduction, and then Josh wrote about the larger medieval cultural milieu that this is a part of, not just encyclopedias, but also maps and travel writing and the understanding of the world from a medieval European perspective and all of these different genres. And the way that the translator of the Marvels was thinking about how this text really fit into a wider conception of the world in both visual and textual forms. And then, Kellen, you wrote an essay with Beth called Wonder and Fear in the Book of Marvels. And I was wondering if you could just talk a little bit about what you guys wanted to cover with that and what you hoped to achieve with that essay.
As I already touched on, the idea for our exhibition was based in this idea of the coexistence of wonder and fear within the Book of Marvels. And we found that in creating the exhibition, the thing we were missing was a way to extrapolate a little bit more on those ideas. It was pretty cursory in the exhibition, as exhibitions often are. In this essay, we really wanted to dig into what makes something wonderful, what makes something fearful, and how those things can coexist in a book like this. So we decided to focus on three separate sections. In our essay, the first was ideas surrounding gender and sex, where we broke down basically how the images and to a little bit of an extent the text as well, how the two worked together to portray women and men in different ways throughout the Marvels, and how they were showing gender and sex differently depending on whether the image was showing a region that was closer to medieval France or farther away, and how those portrayals changed depending on how far away you were getting from the locale in which the purported reader of the manuscript would have been located. So how could they measure themselves against these people who were growing farther and farther away from them? And then the second section that we wanted to explore was behaviors, customs, and religion. A theme that we saw popping up in a lot of the illustrations were depictions of behaviors and customs and even religious traditions, in terms of Judaism for sure, where the author and or illustrator was seeing these behaviors as strange. And it was very clear these things were strange. So you have these hairy men eating only fish in India and things like this. We wanted to, again, focus on how those things were being picked up in both text and image and how things changed as you moved farther away from France. The final section, Beth took a little bit more of a lead on this last section, was the human and animal divide. In a lot of the images, there are human-animal hybrids or humans that have animalistic qualities. And Beth related a lot of that to the bestiary tradition that extends back through centuries of history before the Marvels was created, and how that informed the types of illustrations that were happening. But across the board, what we found was that, yes, things tended to get a little bit more weird the further away that you got from medieval France. Areas such as India and China tended to have slightly more what we might deem offensive depictions of customs, gender, sex, etc. But that wasn't always the case, especially in terms of religion. Sometimes things were much more closer to home in terms of Christians dealing with Judaism. There were some, again, what we would deem offensive depictions of Judaic traditions in areas much closer in even France itself. And so that's something that we found really interesting, is how the texts and images were dealing with concepts of geographic distance, but also distance between types of customs and behaviors that they either perceived were happening or that were actually happening.
Cultural distance in a way.
Yes.
What did you find most challenging about engaging with this material? It is a challenge to recognize things that, as you're saying, we would think of as offensive or potentially demeaning or stereotypical to a sort of extreme degree, but it's included in the text and images of the Marvels as a running list alongside data about the kinds of fruits and vegetables you might find in these places. And it's all conflated on almost the same level of importance. How did you guys deal with that? Or how did you engage with the challenge, I think, of this culturally sensitive material?
Yeah, that's a good question. I feel like it was hard. We went through a lot of edits. Because neither Beth nor I is a specialist in this type of material. And I think that was something that we wanted to be really clear about as we started writing this. We really wanted to make sure that we put the book through several editorial rounds with outside readers who were specialists in this area, because the last thing we wanted to do was come across as if we were championing the ideas that are held in the Book of the Marvels. Because, as I said, to our modern conceptions, these ideas are often very offensive and very demeaning. So we wanted to make sure that we were doing the Marvels justice and that we were explaining the thought process behind the author and illustrator of the Marvels while not reading too much of our own modern preconceptions back on the author and illustrator. And then at the same time, keeping in mind our goal audience of both academics and general public, right? Academics coming to this book hopefully would have a little bit more of an idea of what we were trying to do. But someone coming at this from the general public, the last thing we wanted to do was have them read this essay and come away with them thinking that we think that all of this stuff is amazing. We wanted to show that, yes, the Marvels is great in that it's very interesting and it's a window into a different time, a different thought process of people from the medieval period, but it's also a product of its time in that we don't condone a lot of those ideas anymore, but at the same time, those ideas still exist. And a lot of people have those ideas still.
I think this is such a challenge with these kinds of ideas in historical art, in medieval art, because you do want to call things what they are, which is
exactly, yeah.
Occasionally offensive, occasionally yeah. pernicious, untrue,
yeah.
dangerously stereotypical, while at the same time understanding to the best of our ability the historical context from which they come and in which they were formed. And yeah. I think this is a really difficult line to walk sometimes with the presentation of this material to a more general audience that may not be familiar with the representation of Judaism in Christian contexts or racial difference in Western Europe and the things that connects to, which are entire fields, of course. And we're trying to bring that knowledge and that literature to bear on a single manuscript or even a group of manuscripts for a public that might be seeing all of this stuff for the first time.
Right.
This is such a challenge, I think, with the charge for museums, especially to be relevant, quote unquote, relevant.
Yeah. What does relevant mean?
In a lot of ways, we know what relevant means. It's just, it's a really difficult task
right.
to yeah. try.
How
to
do you
do
bridge that.
That
gap in like a mindful way? You don't want to just do something without a thought, right? Because it's going to affect people. I think that was our main concern, was making sure that we were being mindful of the fact that we're not specialists in that area, but we felt like it was our responsibility to put an essay in the book on that type of topic, because it's not something you can just gloss over. It's like everywhere in the manuscript. You can't just pretend it's not there. I feel like it would be way worse to have not written an essay on something like that than to have tried to do our best.
This is also then something that made it into the idea of the exhibition, putting together the exhibitions. The book was intended to give an introduction to this specific manuscript, the sister copy that's at the Borgen, a little bit of an overview of its contents and relationship to maps, historical writing, encyclopedic writing. What you're saying about these kinds of prejudices and the different kinds of knowledge that were being produced in these manuscripts. I was charged with writing a little bit about the illuminators of the different copies and their relationships to each other. This is my opportunity to rant about names of convenience because they are all over this project. So we don't actually know any of the names of the illuminators who were involved in these projects. We know their names of convenience. So the first copy, the 1420th copy, is attributed to the master of Marguerite d'Orléans. And then the two later copies, the Getty copy and the Morgan copy, are both attributed to the master of the Geneva Boccaccio. These are artists whose works are largely known by stylistic attribution. The set of manuscripts does have a really particular visual approach. The style of them is quite consistent, even between the 1420s copies and then these later copies, which are about 40 years later. They look quite similar, which gives us, I think, some indication that there was some idea that this particular style of illumination felt right for this text and this genre of writing. as we mentioned, the images have a ton of different narrative vignettes within them. There's the sense of travel or a whirlwind tour of different aspects of the world. It's a style that we've given the name colored grisaille, which is this washy approach, which feels, I think, more appropriate for travel writing somehow in a way that is very difficult to actually pin down.
It's a little more illustrative rather than color blocking.
It's less saturated. It allows for slightly more narrative detail in some ways. The Morgan and the Getty copies are attributed to the same artist, but even within them, there's a lot of pictorial variation, which led me to think about collaboration and the role of collaboration in these manuscripts, and that they must have been done rather than by individual artists, must have been done by groups of artists working together. We know that they were both copied for the court of René of Anjou. We don't know the original commissioners for these or even the exact dates that they were made, but they were made very close together in the 1460s and early 1470s, likely. We know that they must have been in demand in some way for being produced relatively quickly. And it seems to me that there must have been some sort of collaborative effort here to make these manuscripts for probably relatively high-ranking members of René's court, which also gives us then a sense of a court that is also looking outward to the Duke's different holdings in international parts of the world. Maybe a court that is particularly interested in these merchant connections or trade connections to these different places. And so we start to get a little bit of a picture of who might have been interested in these manuscripts. The style, I think, would have appealed to them because it was different looking and maybe particular to this kind of writing or this kind of understanding of the kind of different places of the world. This was my opportunity to... try to expand the idea of names of convenience. I think that as art historians, maybe we rely too much on the conception of individual artists, and we don't actually have a great understanding of the way that these manuscripts must have come into existence. But there is an effort to maintain this visual continuity, not just within the individual manuscripts, but then across the manuscripts. So it seems that the Morgan and Getty copies were intended to look quite similar. They're close enough to be, we rarely use the word identical in our history, but they are sister copies, they're sibling copies. They're so close that you can compare one vignette in one to the same vignette in the other, and they're nearly identical.
Very little information is changing from image to image. It's more stylistic.
They're a really interesting set of manuscripts for our understanding of medieval copying and the idea of creating multiples of a particular text that had the same image program for different patrons. It is a way of looking, I think, at medieval art that changes our understanding of copying in particular. We tend to think of copying as bad in modern life, but that the goal of creating these copies is maybe a little bit different for writing like this and something with such a particular stylistic approach that feels really well tailored to the content of the text.
Yeah.
Once the publication was done, then we all had to turn to exhibition planning. I was not as involved with the exhibition as you were, but maybe you could talk about the conception of the exhibition for the Getty's Manuscripts Gallery.
For those of you who have not visited the Getty's Manuscript Gallery, it's one room, so we didn't have a ton of space to elaborate on these really complex ideas. So that was, I think, challenge number one for Beth and I, was how do we do these ideas, due diligence, with limited space? And I wouldn't say limited resources, but it wasn't a loans show, so we weren't really getting loans from anywhere other than the sister copy from Morgan. But we were at the Getty, so we were lucky that we have the Getty's great collection of manuscripts and also access to the Getty Research Institute's collections as well. Beth and my essay from the book is essentially the core of what the Getty's version of the exhibition was. So Wonder and Fear in the Middle Ages. And each section from the essay ended up being a section of the exhibition itself. And how we decided to go about it was we organized the gallery into two sides. We were lucky that we were able to bring the Morgan's copy of the Marvels to LA. And instead of only being able to have the Marvels open to one page, we had two manuscript copies so we could have two pages open. We decided to exhibit two openings that had the most full page of illustrations that we could get. So we chose India and Scythia. One side of the gallery was color-coded blue. The other was color-coded in a more maroon color so you could see how we were making these two full spread images, the touchstones from which everything else in the exhibition called back. And so from there, one thing that I really pulled for was having an interactive aspect to the exhibition. I thought that there was just so much going on in these images that seeing them on the object itself wasn't enough, probably, for a general viewer to get the gist of what was going on in them. So we were really lucky to be able to have two interactive screens, one next to each of the Marvel's manuscripts, where you could go into some of the images within the manuscript and zoom in on the vignettes, click on them, see the text that related to them within the book, and really hit home the relationship between text and image there. In the rest of the gallery, we chose objects from the Getty's manuscripts collection that had images that dealt with the same types of issues that were going on in the images in the Marvel's manuscripts. So we had a couple bestiaries, for example, where you could see the relationship between the bestiary tradition and the types of animal-human hybrids. We had some books of hours that showed some different images. One was of Mary Magdalene, and we talked about the differences in ideas of women and their hair and how those were portrayed differently in someone like Mary Magdalene and then someone that's being shown in India in the Marvels. Finally, we had a loan from the Getty Research Institute. We had a Nuremberg Chronicle that had this great world map that we were able to both display in a case and then have a graphic set above it where we could label where these things were on a map. That was a little bit more in line temporally with when the Marvels was created. Nuremberg Chronicle was a little bit after, a couple decades, showing the general public what the idea of the world was at the time and how far away these places would have seemed to them, I think was really helpful.
There are different decisions that are made in presenting material spatially rather than just in publication form. So as you mentioned, the gallery was divided and color-coded, which some visitors got and some did not.
Yeah.
Some were like, what? It was color-coded? I was like, how did you not see that? We thought so hard about it. There are aspects of display that we really think a lot about and then just get lost on some people,
yeah.
But are absorbed by others. And the combination of blown up details with the interactive and then the objects themselves, I thought worked really well because it gave people a few different ways to engage with the material. There was, I think, a different response to this show than maybe we were expecting. All shows have a variety, a huge spectrum of responses. This show actually had a content advisory, and I'll just read the content advisory because I think this is interesting. It says, the medieval texts and images in this exhibition often demean religions, peoples, and customs in a way that may be disturbing to viewers. This was on the title wall along with the introductory text, and it is one of the first content advisories that we've had, I think, in the manuscripts gallery overall, but one which did not address explicit content of images in the gallery, but rather the social cultural content of images in the gallery. I'm wondering if you could talk about the decision to include a content advisory and why include one for this particular material that addresses it in this way.
We went back and forth a little bit on having a content advisory. At some points, we thought maybe we don't need one, but in the end, I think it goes back to what I was talking about when Beth and I were writing the essay. We want to make it clear that we're not championing the ideas that are presented within the exhibition in terms of ideas that are often seen as demeaning or offensive. We wanted to be clear from the get-go on that title wall that if you continue looking at objects in this exhibition, you might see something that's offensive to you or to your religion or to your ethnicity or to your race. And we just thought it was more respectful to let people know that up front. I hope it was received well, and I hope that it can be useful to people in the future as well, because I think a lot of people want to shy away from exhibiting this material often because it might just be too hard. But I think that you have to find ways of doing your best to make sure that things are communicated in a clear and as non-offensive a way as it can be when the material itself is offensive to a lot of people.
I liked it because I think it acknowledges that while these ideas are medieval in some way, that the exhibition is about the medieval conception of these peoples and places and customs, these objects and these stories and the content still exist in a contemporary world, and so can still have particular effects on people, which we may not be able to even understand before someone sees it. We don't know the cultural backgrounds, the religious backgrounds of people in the galleries, and we expect there to be a huge variety of different people who come through the gallery and look at these images and see them with various amounts of existing knowledge and maybe various levels of interest in the actual exhibition. I think it's good to acknowledge that even though these are historical ideas or ideas that come out of historical artifacts, that all of these things are part of a conversation that is ongoing in the modern world. I hate to get too political, but we've seen, I think, recently, especially the importance of talking about these things, because it is not just relevant, that R word again, it's not just relevant to keep talking about these things, but it's relevant to understand the historical context of them and the history of them, and the ways that they have been talked about and mobilized and used in the past. So there's a way of talking through history, which feels also like part of this conversation and part of the challenge in presenting this material to a huge public audience, both online and in the gallery, trying to take account of a really multicultural audience.
The audience was at the forefront of our mind when we were writing that. From a curatorial perspective, as I said, with the publication, Beth and I are both not experts in this specific area of medieval studies. And so it was really important for us to try to present this material in the most informed way that we could, using different resources, whether they be published resources or professional contacts that we had, reaching out to people who were more knowledgeable than us in this area to get their feedback, making sure that knowledge does get shared, because it's not just for specialists, it's for everybody. And as you said, I think in this day and age, especially, visual rhetoric is hugely important. We're inundated with it all the time. Understanding the power of images and the power of the combination of text and image and how it can influence you to think a certain way. I think it's really important. It's historically important. It's important now. It will always be important.
I totally agree. I think that's actually a great place to probably wrap up the conversation. Thank you so much for talking to me about the marvels and putting together the book and the exhibition. I'll just give a little plug for the Morgan edition of the exhibition, which is called The Book of Marvels, Imagining the Medieval World. It's currently on view at the time that we're recording this. It will be up until May 25th. So if you're in New York and you're interested in the marvels, and who wouldn't be, definitely stop by the Morgan. The Morgan edition was curated by Josh O'Driscoll, our beloved member of Team Marvels. And also a huge thank you to Beth Morrison, senior curator here at the Getty, for spearheading this project and just making it possible.
Also, we have it on good authority that they have giant snail stuffed animals at the Morgan. Check those out.
And the other thing that the medieval folks did not have was merch. And I think Marvel's merch is the next frontier.
Amazing.
Thank you again, Kellen. This has been such a fun conversation. And of course, get the Book of the Marbles, A Medieval Guide to the Globe, which is the publication that goes along with the exhibition.
This has been an episode of the Multicultural Middle Ages, an anthology-style podcast series sponsored by the Medieval Academy of America. Season 4 was produced by Will Beatty, Jonathan Correa-Reyes, Reed O'Mara, Logan Quigley, and me, Lauren Lee, with music by Anna O'Connell. For more information on the MMA podcast, follow the links in the episode description and consider subscribing to keep up with the latest episodes. Thanks for listening.